But I've not committed the last 20 years of my life to bike riding. I've not gone out in the pissing rain doing 7-hour rides. I've not creamed myself, you know, every race as hard as I can, and you know, spent time away from home and family and missed birthdays and everything just to knock it on the head now.
Welcome to the British Continental Podcast, brought to you by Continental. Continental have been supporters of the domestic road scene for over 25 years. The go-to tyre brand for elite riders, from the off-camber cobbled corners of the Durham Tour Series to the farm tracks of the Cycle Classic.
Today's episode is with James Shaw. Now, you might not know this, but not long after I set up the British Continental, towards the end of 2018, the very first interview I did was with James. Back then, he was still reeling from the news that Lotto Soudal had decided not to renew his contract, despite quietly impressing with 2 seasons of reliable, diligent work as a domestique in some of the world's top races, before finishing 10th in the Under-23 World Road Race Championships. As the year was drawing to a close, he told me that time was running out to save his barely begun cycling career. Eventually, though, he joined the newly created UK Continental team Swift Carbon Pro Cycling, hoping to earn the results that would enable him to return to the pro ranks. A successful season followed, with wins in the National Road Race Series and 5th overall in the Tour de Yorkshire, helping him to secure a 1-year contract with the Pro Continental Danish team Rewell Readiness. This year has been a tough one for James, not just because of the pandemic hit calendar, but also because his team hit financial hard times, meaning the riders had to forego wages in order for the team to continue racing. Despite the interruptions, he's put together a very solid year, including selection for the World's Road Race. But now, with the team's future uncertain, he has ended his season once again looking for a contract. With the search not going well so far, James said in a recent Instagram post that he may even have raced his last race of his career. In this interview, James looks back at the last 2 years. From the tough rejection he faced at Lotto Soudal, his season at the domestic level with Swift Carbon Pro Cycling, joining Rewell this year, and the sense of déjà vu he now has as he once again faces an uncertain future in cycling. Before we begin, apologies for the sound quality in this one. Despite trying for ages, James and I weren't quite able to rectify a slightly dodgy line. One of the perils of remote interviewing, I guess. Please do bear with it, though, because James's candidness and honesty is well deserving of a listen. So welcome to the British Continental, James. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. You've just finished your season at Brabantse Pijl. And I guess you're now, well, where are you now that season's finished?
So I'm back at home. It's Derbyshire, England way. I've grown up here majority of my life, but beginning of the lockdown, me and my partner, we invested in our first house together. So we're back home in Derbyshire after finishing Brabantse Pijl on a week ago, last week. So, but yeah, it's strange to finish after only doing, 25 race days or something. It feels a bit bizarre because normally I'd get to the end of the year and I've done, 75 days. I'd be a bit cooked, but I don't feel like I've actually raced at all. So it's a bit of a bizarre feeling, really.
Do you feel ready to kind of continue racing then? Are you, your legs still feeling quite fresh?
My body's pretty fresh. Like I feel like I don't feel any different to normal, but I think actually mentally the season's been one of the toughest seasons it's been to keep training and to, you know, to battle on through not having a clue what's happening mentally. I've found it one of the most challenging seasons going, but physically probably the least demanding season.
For next season, you're kind of unsure what your future is, and I guess this is a situation you find yourself in again. I think the first time that I introduced myself to you was when I just started up the British Continental, and it was the time where you found yourself at the end of your kind of time at Lotto Soudal, having, you know, not been offered a renewal of your contract. And I guess does it feel a bit like deja vu now?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely feels like I'm in the same boat again. A boat I thought I'd never have to be in again. I thought I'd managed to crawl out of this hole. But yeah, a couple of years ago, I'd felt as if I'd had a good season. I was 10th at the under 23 World Championships, and not through any fault of anybody's really, but CCC and BMC merged, Aqua Blue stopped, put a load of riders on the market, and yeah, the team I was with at the time obviously thought they could cash in better elsewhere, and I ended up breaking my collarbone in Lombardia and found myself back at home jobless with a broken shoulder, feeling a bit sorry for myself. And I was in the exact same position I was in now, where I'd finished racing and basically had no idea what I was going to do for the season to come. So yeah, although I thought I'd managed to escape this cell, it seems I've been plonked back in for another period until I could find an alternative route out.
Mm. How tough was it for you? I mean, I know you've done several interviews about it, but just how tough was it in those months after kind of you found out you weren't being renewed with Lotto? You know, what was it like trying to find a team at that point?
Yeah, I was different. It's a slightly different situation to what I'm in now, because I feel like I deserve to stay at Lotto, or I deserve something else to come up, where the situation I'm in now is it's not the fact that Rewild don't want to keep all their riders. I'm sure they do. It's more the case that they can't guarantee it. They've sort of this year's basically they've said, we want to have a team, and if we do have a team, you can all stay, but we can't guarantee there will be a team. So if you want to look elsewhere, if you get an opportunity, please, take it as soon as you can. But I felt like Lotto was more like, we don't want you anymore, sort of thing. And at the time, I wasn't given a particular reason why, or it wasn't explained to me. I was never wasn't given any warning throughout the season. Then nobody ever said to me, a team's not happy with your performances, or you need to pull your finger out a little bit. I thought I was performing well, and like I said, I always performed well at the under 23 Worlds. Mm. And everyone, I've looked at that start that result sheet since, and I've gone, that person's pro, 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 that. Oh, I'm not that person, that person, that person. So it seems a bit bizarre looking back at that. So yeah, the two situations are slightly different, but I think it's the same result at the end, it's the same outcome. I still find myself searching into the abyss for something new. Which again, like last time it was a real struggle. It was a real it's a strange position to be in, because you feel like you've devoted your whole life to something, and you feel like it's it doesn't owe you anything. It's not like cycling owes me a living because I've put my whole life into it. But you sort of stand there and you sort of look at what you've put in and look at what you've got out, and you sort of just leave you a little bit confused as to what you did so wrong when you thought, I thought I'd done everything by the textbook. I thought I'd done the right training here and the right racing here and this and that. So I think maybe it's not necessarily a fault of riders or teams or anything, but this time the COVID has definitely bit us harder than we could have imagined, really.
I mean, going back to 2 years ago, after you were kind of let go by Lotto, I remember you thinking perhaps that you'd been almost too selfless in those 2 years with Lotto, 2.5 years if you count the Stagiaire stint. You'd been from the outside anyway, you'd been a very, very loyal domestique, kind of learning the ropes, and perhaps you felt you hadn't ridden enough for yourself.
Yeah, 100%. The impression I'd got when I went there was it was a bit more for the long haul. It was a little bit, it wasn't going to be so short-lived. The impression I got, what I understood from the agreement, was it was more of a development process, and if I put in 100%, I'd get 100% back out. It was more like use and abuse a little bit, I think, which I think is riders grow up now thinking that it's all going to be like a Team Ineos perfect conveyor belt, that you're going to go on a British cycling program, and you're going to go to the Olympics, then you go to Sky, and then you win the Tour de France, then you retire. It's actually couldn't be further further from the truth, really. I went there and I committed fully to it. But I think, you know, I was a bit naive to think that, you know, the business side of things wasn't going to sort of catch up with me. And obviously, like I said, with AquaBlue and AquaBlue stopping at BMC and CCC sort of merging to become a team, it sort of left a lot of riders out there on the market that, you know, Lotto obviously thought they could, that their pound, that their euro was better spent elsewhere. And that obviously left me in a situation of being sort of a little bit left to fend for myself a little bit.
Yeah. And when I interviewed you at the time, you said time was running out. You eventually joined Swift Carbon Pro Cycling and had a year at the domestic level. Just how close were you to not finding a team at that point?
Yeah, that was, it was very strange. It was, I was very stressful, you know. I was, because at the time as well, I had an agent and he still believed that he could get me a professional deal. And I was like, look, it's February, like professional teams, they've already had two training camps. They're not waiting for, like, let's sign something else. And he still believed he could do it. And I said, look, like, if you still believe we can do it, we've got to go our separate ways. Like, I'm going to sign a deal with a continental team in Britain. I'm just going to do a year. I'm going to commit to it. And he thought, oh no, you know, I probably selfishly thought, oh, you know, he can, he's not going to cash in much from me going to a continental team for a year. But I was like, it's the best investment for myself. I've got to commit to it. And so I did. So yeah, like, I waited the whole winter, trained a normal winter like I would, not having a clue what was happening. Like, really sort of like, I just felt like I was pissing into the wind every day. It was really sort of like a bizarre way of training. But then in come February, joined the team of Swift Carbon, which obviously was new to the scene last year. And maybe it was a bit of a gamble because we didn't know what races we were going to do, didn't know the kit and bikes were going to arrive on time. They said no idea what was happening in February sort of time. So yeah, that then sort of went in a bit blind, really. And so I had to commit to it. You know, it wasn't like going to a continental team that had been around for a few years that I could sort of knew or rely on. You know, teams like JRT had died. NFTO, obviously, a bit of dust a few years ago. There's basically Madison and Canyon left and Vitus, and being the three biggest teams left in the UK, they'd obviously been full from November, December time. So yeah, it was left to a new, fresh team to start the 2019 season.
How did you find the year? I mean, that must have been quite an adjustment, especially, I mean, not just riding for a really fresh team and the uncertainty, but you hadn't really ridden much in the UK until then, had you? I mean, certainly not the domestic races.
Yeah, definitely. I think as far as my British racing had gone was the national champs. That was it. I'd basically been an amateur from the age of 18. I moved to Belgium and went to live and race there. So I got very little racing. So the last time I would have raced in the UK before 2019 would have been as a junior in 2014. So yeah, it was a completely different ball game, and I took a bit of getting used to it. It was a very different style of racing, and to be honest, there were some bits I really enjoyed. I loved the fact that it was never more than a couple of hours drive home, that it wasn't going to be like going to Down Under where it was like 24 hours on a plane after a race kind of thing or something like that. Everything was like within a couple of hours drive, which I thought was brilliant. Like, you know, I could leave a race and know that I was always going to get in my own bed. I wasn't going to have to stay in some like dodgy Premier Inn in the far end of Charleroi and then get a rubbish Ryanair flight all the way home the next day. Like, I knew that it was going to be like, right, pack my bag up, right, let's get home sort of thing. But I really enjoyed that aspect to it. I thought I was brilliant. Like, I could always be home. But then, yeah, there's some really different, you know, really different style of racing. Was there wasn't this sort of like world tour style of racing where four men go up the road and then the leading team will sit on the front of the day and pull it back and you just race the last hour. It was like, yeah, guys working 40-hour weeks as postmen or whatever, and then they'd come to the bike race at the weekend, and they'd think, right, okay, I'm just going to attack for the first 2 hours. I remember doing Klondike, was my first race in the UK, and after 2 hours, just thinking, I don't know how I'm going to keep this pace up. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, it's just every, like, attack goes, some real strong guy, really keen, or pull it back, and then another person goes, and then another guy would sit on the front and pull it back. And after 2 hours, I'm thinking, what is going on? Then gradually after that, like, more, you'd soon find that, like, the peloton wasn't, like, 120 guys, it was, like, 30. And then it was just, like, 15, and then it was just 10. Where, yeah, I guess in a world tour race or whatever, it'd be, oh, everyone starts, four guys go, you have a quick chat at the back of peloton, quick wee, peloton, you know, lead team go on, pull it back and race the last hour.
It certainly seemed like you had a really consistent year. I mean, you got, you know, fourth in the Tour du Loir-Echer, which in April, and then a fifth overall in the Tour de Yorkshire. You got a top 10 in the Polish stage race that you raced. And then you obviously, as you say, you won Rydell, the Reservoir. And you were really prominent in the Tour of Britain, whilst, you know, perhaps not getting the result you might have wanted. So, you know, it seemed like you, throughout the year, you were, you know, you were in good form.
Yeah, no, I think, like, in terms of, like, consistency, probably one of the best years I've had. I found that, like, not doing that much racing, but actually being able to train a bit more, and, like, not having these, you know, the silly travel days, like I was saying, actually allowed me to recover, get home, sleep, and then get training again, which I guess gave me that ability to sort of hold a more consistent form, where, like, in the past, obviously, like, you race here, there, and everywhere, and traveling and learning to travel and learning to chill out while traveling is a massive part of bike racing that I think people sometimes overlook. I think maybe as teams get bigger and bigger, it'll be more about, you know, buying private jets and stuff, and that'll be the easiest way to travel, who knows. But yeah, I certainly, racing in the UK allowed me to sort of pick and choose how I trained a bit more, as opposed to saying, right, well, I can't train that day because, you know, I'm on this flight, or I can't do this, I can't do that. It was a lot easier to sort of make a plan and stick to it and yeah, recover and train harder.
And you mentioned the fact that it was an adjustment for you in terms of the style of racing. Was it also an adjustment for you in terms of, I guess, learning how to become a team leader after, you know, being such a kind of loyal domestique over your time at Lotto?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, really, isn't it, in the UK? Like, especially on that team, whereas I think there's a little, no one's being paid, so it's a bit difficult to turn to someone and say, right, you know, you're going to go and get my bottles today, or, like, you're going to, you know, if a breakaway goes away and it's too many guys, you're going to ride on the front. And, you know, it'd be almost easy for a young lad who's not being paid to turn around and say, well, why should I, sort of thing? But I think that as a team, like, we got on really well. Like, the lads, so we were all sort of committed to winning the bike race. If it wasn't me, it was like I was committing just as hard for somebody else or something like that. I think the fact that we were all there, and the fact there was no sort of financial ego or anything like that, we were all there because we actually wanted to race bikes. So it gave us a bit of a, yeah, external motivation that we could all sort of get stuck into, that we all had one thing that brought us together, was the fact that, you know, as long as one of us from the team won, we didn't actually care who it was. But yeah, no, I don't think, I wouldn't say per se I was the leader. Obviously there was, you know, if we went to a race like Tour of Yorkshire, a lot of the time I'd be the only guy left from our team, or, you know, Jake obviously spent a lot of time up the road in breakaways and things like that. So yeah, no, it was a bit different. But when you come from a team like Lotto, and you've, you know, guys like Thomas De Gendt and Tim Wellens and the like, I think you learn a lot from seeing what they do and how they do it, and the way they sort of approach a leadership style role within the team. And yeah, then obviously replicating that's another thing.
I guess the follow-up question then was, you know, was it a struggle for you kind of off the bike? I mean, you know, financially, mentally during that year, just you know, keeping things going?
Yeah, financially it was a struggle, and I won't go too far into it, but yeah, basically got flipped by the team and didn't get what I was contractually agreed to. So yeah, financially struggled. Luckily, my other half worked full time. She's a tour guide with Trek. So luckily we could, we weren't that dependent on financing it. I considered myself young enough last year to see it as a investment year in my future sort of thing, to sort of say, all right, okay, well, I can take the financial hit in the hope that, you know, this year was going to be financially better. But it was a difficult change. It was a difficult time. And yeah, I think I'm still pleased with how I approached and how I adapted myself. And I feel like there was a couple of other riders in my situation last year. I feel like I approached the situation of being, you know, dropped from a professional rank and having to join a British Continental team. I feel like I took that on the chin, and, you know, I guess take a bit of humble pie, you know, and I think it'd be too easy to almost let your ego get the better of you and think, oh, you know, I don't want to race in the UK because you've ridden for this team or because you've had the privilege of riding on that team or whatever. I think you have to put that behind you and accept that, right, you're going to go to the UK and you're going to race hard. And if you get beat by a better man, you've got to go home, train a bit harder and come back another day. I think, you know, the UK, I know it's struggling as an industry at the minute, but there's still a lot of talent cooped up in these teams that's not got the ability to sort of break this cycle of being stuck in the UK. There's talented guys out there that hold their ground on most professional teams. It's just the UK is sort of suffocating them a little bit and it's not allowing them to sort of reach their full potential.
Yeah, I mean, certainly last year there were quite a number of guys from the domestic scene kind of, you know, stepping up to the pro ranks, and I guess including Matt Holmes, who I guess is demonstrating, you know, just how well a domestic rider can do at the moment in the Giro. What stage did you start talking to other teams? I mean, how early did the interest come? How easy it was it to kind of find yourself a contract this season?
I mean, I'll be honest, it didn't come as easily as I hoped or thought it might. It was a little bit of a bit of a waiting game, as you know, teams weren't particularly I don't know, like, I'm going to say not like they weren't interested, like they were interested, but it was like, oh, you know, maybe we can do this, or maybe we can get, you know, get this deal or something like that. So it actually took a while to get something. And in the end, Rewell approached me after the Tour of Britain and said, well, you know what, like, we'll actually put a contract under your nose. We'll actually make the offer. So, and at the time, I didn't have another option. Like, it was that or maybe stay in the UK and consider racing, you know, kind of make a living out of doing that. But, you know, like, the original plan was that the Tour would start in Denmark in 2021 and that Rewell would, as a Danish team, potentially have the option to start racing there. So it seemed like a good investment. And I thought, actually, yeah, you know, I got a good calendar. They offered a good financial support. The team itself actually offered support in terms of the way they approach things. You know, they offered, they said, oh, you know, sort it out with a coach if you've got one, or X, Y, and Z. So yeah, the Rewell, really, they wanted me, where other teams, I think it was like, I wanted to go there, but they were sort of holding out, potentially waiting for something else, or, you know, the space could be filled elsewhere. Where Rewell, they wanted me, which I think was my key draw to them, was the fact that somebody wanted me, and it was the fact that I was being chosen as opposed to, you know, having to wait for, you know, some big hitter somewhere on World Tour Team Society didn't want to go there. it was sort of like Rewild were like, yeah, you know, we want you. We, you know, they were replying to emails fast and, you know, making phone calls and stuff where, you know, I understand a lot of managers are busy, but it's nice to be wanted from a team. At that point, I thought, like, you know, I'm going to do this deal and commit the best I can to it.
Had you found yourself a new agent at this point?
One of the managers at Rewild, or one of the sports directors, a bloke called Michael Skelder, who's he's top, you know, he's really on his game, and he was a director at Cool Energy, I think it was called, where Rush rode for, and I was good friends with Russ, and he said, oh, you know, like, contact this bloke at Rewild and, you know, see where it goes, and I contacted him, and at the time, Skelder had, he'd fallen off his bike and broken his hip. And it was one night in the Tour of Britain, I called him. I must have been on the phone to him for hours. I don't know how many painkillers he must have been on. He was going on and on and on about this team. I was like, look, I've got to go. Like, you know, I'll ring you back after the race. And it was the next day that their sort of their second sports director came up to me on the start line or after sign on. He was like, oh, yeah, so you spoke to Skelder and, yeah, you know, we'd really be interested. And it was at the Tour of Britain that the ball got rolling. I was fairly fortunate enough that I knew a few Danish guys, and I didn't know many of the Scandis, but you know, I knew a small handful that were already at the team and things like that. And yeah, the ball sort of got rolling at Tour of Britain, and like I say, after that they were, you know, always really quick to reply and really punctual, and I was like, fucking hell, you know, these boys are organised and, you know, they want me. Like, it sounds like, you know, and like I say, it was really nice to sort of be wanted by a team. So yeah, it sort of, yeah, I think it's like a bit more Russ. Russ was basically my agent last year. That's basically how it worked.
Well, I'm sure he'll be asking you for your commission at some point. How are you handling things this year?
I've taken a similar sort of approach to last year, and obviously the situation with Rewild is it's complicated. If there's a team, you know, they've said yeah we'll have you back, but if there is a team is obviously the big question mark. But I'm not going to hold them to that, and equally they've been very upfront and frank about the situation to us and said, look, you know, financially this sponsor's gone, we're going to need something else, and the, you know, we don't know at the minute if it's going to go ahead, so feel free to jump ship. So I've tried my best to contact who I can, where I can, and everything. But I mean, it's a seller's market at the minute, isn't it? They can choose who they want to sell the contract to at the minute. It's a bit, yeah, it's really difficult, and you know, teams aren't short of riders. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of teams are already full from the rosters of last year of guys that haven't really had a chance to race. But I'm in the process of trying to sort something. It takes up a lot of time. It's a lot more time than I thought it would be. In the process of potentially working with an agent who, yeah, you get to a point yourself where you've exhausted your own contact book, and I think you need somebody else to bring their contacts in. I think in a difficult time like this, an agent is certainly someone that can shine a bit of light on a potentially dark situation. But yeah, things at the minute are a bit stuck. It's not the way you plan your career when you're a kid. When you're a 15, 16-year-old watching the Tour, you don't ever think that you're going to get to 24 and have to retire. But it's been a bit of a strange process, really. There's a spectrum of people out there where on one end there's a bloke working for a team that may or may not be Continental next year. I'm not sure if that's official yet, but you can probably guess who it is. And he's out there, he's bending over backwards to try and find money to help me out for next year. He's, you know, doing all he can, and he's honestly trying to, he's a great bloke. And then you get some managers that come along and, oh yeah, you know, you can ride for us and we'll give you a bike and a jersey, but that's about it. And you think, well, a bike and a jersey isn't going to pay my mortgage, is it, really? But it's a stressful time, and that I would say I get up some mornings and I think, I'll tell you what, I'll just sack this up and go and become a.
The sense I get from you, James, is that your enthusiasm for cycling has dimmed somewhat. I mean, you know, 2 years ago you seemed prepared just to do anything to continue your career, whereas now I think maybe, I don't know, it seems like you've got a new perspective. Is that fair?
I think where 2 years ago I was willing to accept that I basically didn't have any responsibilities. I was, all right, 2 years is not a massive amount of time, but actually a lot has changed. Unfortunately, my other half lost her job in March as well, being a tour guide, travel tour guide. That's obviously gone completely down the pan. So it's more become a case of last time I'd have done anything to keep riding because I didn't suspect that I'd be in that boat again, where now I'm in the position where, I can't go to the bank and say, oh, actually, you know what, I'm not that interested in paying this month because I haven't got the money, but I really want to keep my house, sort of thing. So I got to a position where, like, a lot's changed and I've got to, I not grow up, but just meet the demands of real life. You know, it's not, I don't live at the time last year. I could, you know, I always go home because it was where my parents lived. It was the house that they owned outright, where, you know, I have to make my own ends meet now. So it's not the fact that I'll still do anything within reason to remain a professional bike rider. You know, I've not committed the past, what am I now, 24? I've not committed the last 20 years of my life to bike riding. I've not gone out in the pissing rain doing, you know, 7 hour rides. I've not creamed myself, you know, every race as hard as I can, and you know spent time away from home and family and missed birthdays and everything just to knock it on the head now. But it's out of my control a little bit now. It's sort of, yeah, it's unfortunately not me making the decision. And you know, there's obviously Cavs out there at the minute and he's still searching for a ride, and you know, I did Brabant Sepal, and I was well aware that may be my last race, which is different for Cav, isn't it? You know, he's been there, he's done that, he's achieved what he wants to achieve, and he's had an incredible career, and for him to retire now, it's not a bad thing, is it? You know, he's done enough. Where I kind of feel like when I was a kid, growing up racing as a junior, watching guys like Wiggins win the tour, and thought, oh yeah, you know, I'll get stuck in and give that a go myself. Nobody told me about this side of the sport that could, you know, it's a dark, twisted sort of myth. You know, it's all kept on the down low, isn't it? It's all sort of kept hush hush. Nobody tells you that there's dropouts of salaries and things. Yeah, you hear these horror stories on teams, but it's, you know, it's like the holidays from hell, isn't it? You never think they'll actually happen to you, but I've had two of those holidays from hell in the past 3 years, so it's a bit bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, this year's been tough as well, hasn't it? I mean, not only have you had the interrupted season, but you've all had to take a pay cut, is that right, at the team?
Yeah, pay cut basically. All the offer was you could either race and not get paid or get paid and not race. And we sort of came to a decision, and then we were sort of told by the managers, actually, you know what, if you don't race, the chances are they won't have a job, so you're having a salary cut and you will race. So which is what we'd have chosen anyway, of course. You know, like, as the competitive nature people we are, of course we'd have chosen the racing over the green stuff, to try and further our own end to gain a contract for the coming seasons. Obviously without racing, then you're definitely not gonna go and prove yourself, are you, if you just sat at home taking in a taking in your salary. So, yeah, basically the deal was we will put the salary aside and basically ride for free as long as we could. As long as we could still race, which sparked mixed emotions in the team, as you can imagine. Some of the guys got sent to, I was fortunate enough to do the professional races and do Brabant Appel and high category races, and I would have done Amstel Gold if it had gone ahead. And then some guys, they got to do a couple of lower division races, and that was it. They did two races, but they'd taken a salary cut just for that. Nobody won in the situation. The team didn't win because, they're still in the situation. The riders lost out because we lost the salary for races we've normally done anyway. And we're not the only team in this situation. NTT are putting me in the same boat with whatever might happen with that team. That's the big question mark. And I think the guys at CCC are in exactly the same boat as well. Is that team, I get an impression that's guaranteed it'll stop. But yeah, Rewell and NTT are question marked as potentially, if they can find a sponsor, why they don't just merge together and become one team. I don't know. That would surely be the logical thing to do. But politics, I think, might be the spanner in the works on that front.
Yeah, because of course there's the Danish connection, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Bjarne is well aware of the situation, and I think I'm 99% sure Bjarne ran the team with ran a Danish continental team with Skelder in 2017-2018 called Woohoo Racing or something like that. Surely each is aware of each other's situation. But I think it's easy to sit here not knowing the inside knowledge, isn't it, and say, do this. It's every guy in the pub can cook into World Cup success, can't you? So I think it's a little bit of that syndrome, is actually we don't know the ins and outs. And, maybe if NTT haven't got a South African license, then NTT fold and everyone's back to square one. The sponsor don't want to put money in, and maybe Rewell want to remain Danish. They don't want to become a South African team. And, we don't know what the ins and outs are. It's easy for us to see here and speculate and point fingers. I'm sure they've considered it, and I'm sure all teams have communicated and said, we'd like to join forces. But I think it's more complicated than meets the eye, isn't it? But everyone's, all teams are out there working as hard as they can to try and make themselves more sustainable for the years to come. I don't think anybody can deny that, because we're all in need of a bit of work next year. But we'll have to see what happens. I think as well, is it's going to be a waiting game. A lot of teams will wait for results post the Vuelta, maybe. Who knows? That's if that goes ahead, who knows? I'm surprised that after the Tour de France and the Worlds that any racing got ahead. I was almost 100% sure that when the World Championships was done, I thought that was going to be the last race of the year. But here we are, we're still going.
Yeah, and I guess that, as you say, that's a very unusual situation anyway. Normally by now the season's pretty much over, isn't it? And
if you don't know what you're doing by this time of year, you're in a bit of a pickle, aren't you? But this year it seems to be the norm, doesn't it? There's 80-90 guys out there that are still looking, wondering, I wonder what I'm going to do next year. So who knows?
I get the sense from you. You feel very much powerless. There's not much in your control.
Oh, 100%. it's way out of my control now. I've just got to pray and hope that I get a bit of luck. I like to think I've put the majority of my bad luck behind me. But apparently, some people make their own luck. whatever that means. But yeah, I think I'd like to think that the majority of the worst part of my career is over. But who knows? It's certainly a decision. Yeah, I've got to make the decision at the end. But I think the decision will largely be made for me, as I will just be, I'll be dictated to by powers above me.
Mm. I mean, it feels like you are, you talk about luck, and certainly on paper, it seems like you've been incredibly unlucky. You've never really had a kind of a proper run at it in a way. You know, as you say, you were 10th in the under 23 in your last under 23 world championships. You joined Lotto when you were just 20, and you seemed to transition to that team, you know, incredibly well. You seemed an accomplished part of that world tour set up at such a young age. You made the most of last year, got some cracking results, including the fifth at Tour de Yorkshire and so on. And even this year, you know, despite the interrupted season, you were chosen to ride the Worlds for Great Britain, and you know, you've had some solid results despite, as you say, you feel like you haven't really got going. It must be frustrating, you know, thinking what could have been if only you'd been at a team and had a chance to kind of really develop and, you know, had a bit more certainty.
Yeah, 100%. Things definitely got off to a good start. Like, you know, I felt like I hit the ground running. But I was putting in the hours, I was putting in the hard yards. And then things started to, unravel rather quickly. And I look at certain people now or certain results and I think, well, you know, actually, like, I beat you consistently last year or, you know, I raced you that year and we were on the same team and I know how good that person is and I've just seen them do this result or them do really well in that. I think, if I was given the same opportunities, what could I do? You have to self-assess, don't you? So I've been in this situation, three times in the past three seasons. I start to wonder if I'm doing something wrong, like, is it me or like have I just been unlucky, you know? Like, yeah, there's only so much bad luck you can have, but then you have to start self-analyzing, don't you, and say, well, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe I am doing something wrong, you know, am I a problem person? Am I always causing problems? Is that why teams don't want you, or is it just bad luck? And I certainly think this year, like, it's nobody's fault, it's not the team's fault, it's not my fault, it's that bloke at the bat in China. He's caused all this, hasn't he? I don't think anybody could be blamed for the current state of the current situation I'm in. I can't point a finger and say, oh, it's that person's fault. But yeah, nobody predicted the coronavirus. Nobody suspected anything, did they? It was more a case of, it was sprung upon us. And I think, to be honest, for the majority of teams to still be functioning at this late point in the year, given what has happened, I think it's impressive in itself. And I'm not sure Brexit's helping the situation that much either.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just so much uncertainty, isn't there, especially for sponsors in the UK at the moment. Do you have any regrets then?
No, not regrets. I have things I'd do differently. If I could do it again, I wouldn't regret them. Or, you know, if somebody said, what would you advise? I'd say, from my experience, you know, do this or don't do this. I don't regret it. Like I said it earlier, you can only make a decision on the information you're presented with at the time. And at the time, I made the decision I did. With hindsight, it's easy to say with hindsight, isn't it? Oh, you know, do this, do that. I think that's... hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But there's nothing I'd regret. Yeah, I'd do things differently given my time again, and I certainly feel like I've maybe slipped the net a little bit. I don't know, there seems to be a lot of riders that are of my ability, that are of my caliber, that are of my fitness, of my age, that are well exceeding, on paper anyway, the results that I would be deemed to perform. But maybe, you know, I overrate myself. maybe I need to take a step back and actually think, maybe I need to assess the way I do this or the way I do that compared to somebody else, or, you know, maybe I need to do something differently or learn a new, you know, add a new string to my bow, as it was. And I can't win GC, so then I'm going to become a breakaway specialist, or I can't do, you know, maybe I need to put a alternative strategy to my racing to keep myself in the game. Who knows, you know, it's, yeah, I spend a lot of time, especially this year, you know, we've basically had a whole year just sitting at home, haven't we? It's been a long year of looking at yourself in the mirror and analysing and, you know, self-reflecting, because it's not really been that much else to do. I want to remain in cycling. Like, you know, when I left Lotto, I was a bit down, you know. I was a bit like, oh, do I want to carry on? And the thing that kept me going was, like, all my friends were saying, oh yeah, you can't stop now, you know, you might actually achieve something, or, you know, my girlfriend was saying, she raced and she stopped, and she said, I think you should carry on. And I've sort of carried on because other people wanted me to, not because I wanted to. And pretty much the same as last year as well, as I got to a point and I was thinking, actually, you know what, like, I've ridden pretty well, but I don't really know if I want to carry on. But I've got to this end of this season, and the only thing I know for sure is that I want to carry on racing. It's the only time I've got to the end of a season, and yeah, and I thought, oh, what is it, time to knock it on the head, or, you know, and I want to do it more than ever. But it's strange that the year I want to do it more than ever is looking the most likely to be the year that might be. My path might already, my fate might be decided for me, sort of thing. But I'm doing all I can to remain in cycling and to try and sort of, you know, get a contract, and even to the extent of maybe trying to find a, not an alternative source of income, but like a top up, you know, like a little money maker on the side, just to sort of tide me over for one more year. And I told myself when I went to Swift, it's just 1 year, you know, just tie yourself over, and then, you know, things will pick up. And I think things have got to pick up soon, haven't they? Like, things can't keep getting worse and worse. Like, you know, at some point we've got to turn. I mean, we're being told, aren't we, that, you know, the cycling industry is booming, that the lockdown and the COVID virus has caused a spike in people buying bikes and all this. So you'd hope that would have a positive, you know, effect on the sponsorship and the money that people put into cycling. So hopefully we'll see that within the next few months. But who knows? It's a bit of a guessing game at the minute.
Well, James, I really, really appreciate your kind of openness and honesty. So even if it's not, you know, perhaps the happiest of stories so far, but I mean, there's still time left. And as you say, it's a very unusual season, and hopefully there'll still be opportunities for you to pick up that contract you're looking for. Thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then please do leave us a nice review. You can subscribe on all the usual channels, and you can follow us on social media. On Twitter, we are at British Conti, and on Instagram, we are at the British Continental. And please do visit our website for more interviews, journals, previews, and news at thebritishcontinental.co.uk.